Welcome back to the Read Connected podcast. Season 4 is all about connection. Connection with others, connection with something outside of ourselves, and the connections we make within ourselves. How we connect is dependent upon our attention. What and who we focus on and give our attention to ultimately can lead to what and who we connect with. As I always say, attention is a function of how we prioritize what we find most important. And this is all based on the resources we have available to attend and focus our attention. Resources, especially these days, are so taxed and limited. However, I believe our attention and time are two of our most valuable resources that can be underappreciated or easily stolen. As President Theodore Roosevelt is known to have said, comparison is the thief of joy. So too can our digital, fast-paced culture be the thief of our attention, or is it? As we discussed in our previous episode, living in this digital age, our attention is constantly being pulled in every which way and direction. We are told, or maybe we tell others, to pay attention, focus. This is especially prevalent in schools or with young people as they learn new concepts or skills. Lately, we hear from learners and those in the workforce alike that attention is something we can all improve. Coaches and parents yelling from the sidelines, teachers orienting their students, parents trying to have a conversation with their child. Pay attention, focus. The prevalence and rate of referrals at schools has also increased. But do we really understand what attention is? Do we understand what impacts our attention and how? Do we understand what we're trying to improve? Today, we're thrilled to be joined with Dr. Gloria Mark, a research psychologist who has dedicated the last two decades of her career trying to understand attention and how it is impacted by digital technology. We'll bring in insight from working with individuals from both the psychotherapy and executive function worlds, as we are constantly trying to help people improve the way in which they navigate through their lives. Gloria Mark is a Chancellor's Professor Emerita at UC Irvine. For over two decades, she's researched the impact of digital media on people's lives, our distractions, attention, multitasking, and stress. She has authored over 200 papers and is a member of the ACM-CIG-CHI Academy, which recognizes leaders in her field. Her work has appeared on NPR's Hidden Brain, Sanjay Gupta's CNN Chasing Life, CBS Sunday Morning, one of our favorites, in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, among many others. Her recent book is Attention Span, about our dwindling attention in the digital age, named by The Globe and Mail as the number one best business and management book of 2023. But I believe that it's beneficial for all to read and to embrace. Gloria, we're so excited to have you here. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, Jer, do you want to get started?
Yeah, Gloria, this is such a joy, the wealth of knowledge that you are going to be able to provide this conversation. And we have listeners who are people we work with, their parents, families, and just, you know, our general audience are really interested in this topic. So, you know, one of the first things we really want to set the stage, we try to start broad with our conversations, and we want to try to kind of narrow it down from there. So, you know, the first question I want to ask is, what is attention? As Alexis said in the introduction, you know, we talk about attention. We want people to focus better, pay more attention. But can you give us kind of like almost like a psych 101 idea about what is attention? And we'll kind of dive in deeper from there. You know, what are the types of attention that we can have and enact just to kind of help us to set the stage for this conversation?
Yeah. So it's a great question. And, you know, people have studied the mechanics of attention for over 100 years, but very few people actually stop and consider what attention actually is. Mm. And I like to go back to William James, who's considered the father of psychology. Mm. And William James talks about attention as, you know, giving your whole mind, your mind's resources, the concentration and focalization on something, right? So William James didn't quite get it all right, because what we've discovered since then is that there are different kinds of attention. So he was talking about attention that's voluntary, where people are in control. It's also known as controlled processing. But there's another kind of attention, which is automatic. And in our digital age, we experience a lot of that. And automatic attention is when our minds are drawn to something, some stimulus. It could be a notification. It could be something flashing on your screen. It could be the sight of your smartphone, right? And I have my smartphone right here and I'm looking at it. And we respond to these stimuli and we can't help but respond. And that's automatic. And this, in contrast to controlled processing, which involves a lot of effort to be able to focus, this doesn't involve any effort at all. And so that's why people can do things like play mindless games for many, many hours because it's effortless, right? And it's rote and it's automatic. So these are different kinds of attention.
And I think it sounds like there's kind of a parallel to the word, the unconscious that we use in psychotherapy, that our attention could be pulled in different directions, as you said, in a way that's not conscious, it's not willful, it's just kind of happening automatically as a reaction. Certainly important for us to remember as psychotherapists. I'm going to kind of circle back to that later in the episode, but I think that's an important kind of comparison as to what you're saying.
Yes, absolutely.
I love how you talk about kinetic attention in your book, because I think it is really representative of the way we live in our life. I talk about how we have this frenetic motion, like everybody's constantly in motion, even when we're not in motion a lot these days. And I think when we think about attention from a different perspective, and I hope you can share a little bit more about your definition of kinetic attention, I think it helps us to realize that it's really difficult to capture our attention or to have more mindful focus of it because of so many different variables and stimuli in the environment.
Real quick, I just want to make a quick point because I was thinking about the internet and I was thinking, you know how the internet, I think you mentioned this, Gloria, in your book, and Alexis did this unbelievable job of outlining your book, is that the internet is just an endless amount of information. And I think you said in your book, Gloria, it's constantly being fed more and more and more. It's like infinite amount of information, and just nothing has ever existed like that, where you can just keep feeding it more and more and more and more. And I was thinking to myself, being within the internet, kind of like when you're like in the Matrix, you're kind of plugged into it. When you're using the internet, it's almost like you're entering into a brain that has like severe ADHD. Because it's just like information everywhere. And how do you make sense of it? How do you navigate it? How do you prioritize, as Alexis always says? How do you categorize it all? It's like, and I feel like, you know, what is that doing to our brains to enter into a world that basically is like a severely ADHD brain?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, kinetic attention, the idea for it came out of my research. So, you know, as I was observing people over the years when they're using their devices, I didn't expect that people were going to be switching their attention as rapidly as we observed. So, you know, initially 20 years ago, we found that people spent about 2.5 minutes on any window, right? That means any application or any device before switching. And then fast forward in the last 6 years or so, people are spending about 47 seconds on average. So if you're observing a person, you watch them just continually switching applications. They're switching windows. They're working on something and then suddenly they switch to email. Then they switch to the web. Then they switch to a different document. And I was searching for some kind of word to describe this phenomenon. And it was very difficult to find some kind of descriptor. And it suddenly occurred to me in physics, the idea of kinetic energy, which is very dynamic, seemed to be a pretty good way to describe what we were observing. So it's very different than attending to something for a long period of time and getting into a kind of deep focus. But it's just really bouncing around. Your mind is bouncing from one one app, one window to another. And it's like you talked about the, yes, the internet is this, you know, I describe it as this museum with endless rooms. Hmm. You know, if you've been to a museum before, you may not want to go back, but because the internet is, you know, because of its open architecture, anyone can contribute and it just keeps growing and growing. And so there's always something new that can be experienced. And this contributes to our kinetic attention.
It's so interesting because in my work, especially with younger learners, the children often have a difficulty in, you know, cognitive flexibility, being able to switch, to be able to transition. And exactly what you all are describing is this constant shifting. And I hear it all the time, especially from the young people I work with and even the older ones, that a lot of times they're thinking that they're multitasking. They're able to do so many different things at the same time. And I know there's this myth of multitasking that I'd love for you to share based on the research and the work that you've done. But it's so fascinating that sometimes the thing that's most difficult for students to do, especially when they have goal-directed tasks, is something that they're constantly doing in their leisure and entertainment time, which is so fascinating.
Oh, you know what? This is great. So I think exactly what you both are saying is they're so good at unconsciously, cognitively being flexible and switching between things, but they're not doing it intentionally. Mm. And you're saying that when they actually have to do it intentionally for a purpose in a very adaptive, helpful way, they struggle with it perhaps because they're so used to unconsciously reacting to stimuli and switching and being flexible in that type of way, but it's not very, it's not necessarily intentional and helpful.
Yeah, and it's also a matter of what they're interested in, right? So our attention, as you point out, it's very goal-directed. And it's also driven by what we're interested in. And children have learned a habit of being on the internet, you know, watching videos. And so they, you know, they've acquired this habit. And as a result, that's developed into an interest for them. And so they seek out what they're interested in. And it happens to be a lot of social media, videos, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the reminder that you share in the book too about, you know, kind of like this technological and digital snacking, that we're taking little bite-sized bits of things, but we're not necessarily totally consuming. And in my work, especially when I'm working with educators and parents, I'm talking so much about how we're not necessarily getting to deeper levels of learning. There's so much surface level interaction with information that's happening. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your research and your work, thinking about how deeply folks are getting when you were measuring how much time on task that they were focusing their attention and how they were feeling as a result of how they were focused. And there's a number of different studies that you report in your book, so you could pick and choose which one makes the most sense, I guess, to address this.
So when people spend a short amount of time on something, they're not deeply processing it, right? And if you're switching every 47 seconds on average, you're not taking the time to fully absorb and reflect on that material, because that requires time, right? And we can't do everything in a very fast way, right? Some things you can grasp very quickly and intuitively, but other things takes us a while to be able to get into it. Earlier, you talked about the myth of multitasking, and that's related to it. There is this idea that humans are capable of parallel processing, do two things at once. We really can't. What we are doing is switching our attention. And if you're on a Zoom meeting, you can't do that and do your email at the same time. A child cannot do their homework and at the same time watch a TV show, right? What they're doing is they're switching their attention. And some people feel that it's a badge of honor to be able to multitask. They feel they can accomplish more, they can be more productive, but we're actually doing less when we're switching our attention so rapidly. We know from just decades of research that people make more errors when they multitask. We know that from laboratory research. We know that from research in the wild, that when people are continually attending to different things, they neglect some things and make errors. We know that it takes longer to accomplish any single task if you're switching among them compared to if you were to finish one task and then begin another one, finish that, and then begin another. So doing things sequentially, we can actually do them quicker than switching between them, because every time you switch your attention, there's what's called a switch cost. Mm. And a switch cost is the extra time it takes to reorient to that new task. And also effort. There's effort involved as well. And the third reason why multitasking should not be considered a badge of honor to wear, because it causes stress. And it's not just correlational, but it actually causes stress. Mm. And again, we know that from many decades of laboratory research. We know that for even my own research where people wore heart rate monitors, and you know, we tracked them using their devices, and we could see at the exact times when their attention was shifting rapidly that their stress went up as measured by the heart rate monitors. And of course, people subjectively report feeling more stressed. So switching our attention so rapidly like that is just not beneficial. Morris, and you talked about being able to deeply process things. We just can't.
I think in your book you had mentioned the more complex the task is, the harder, the more that switching is a negative, has a negative consequence. Meaning that, like, if you're doing a higher and higher a complex task, the switching is going to have real negative impact in terms of your ability to do it efficiently and accurately. And so I wonder if, you know, people, in some ways to compensate for that, try to simplify what they're doing and to try to make it seem like it's more simple than it really is. Because I think, that makes sense.
Well, one way to simplify tasks is to break it up into simpler components. Mm. And if you really want to, or you need to take a break from a task, there are certain break points in a task. And those are the best times to take a pause. And a break point could be anything from, say, you're reading something, the end of a chapter, right? That's a break point. You've finished that material, take a break before you move on to the next. Mm. Or if you're typing something, you know, you finish an idea, you finish a section, writing section. And then you can take a pause. So complexity could be made simpler. And, it's like in project management, if you're familiar with that, you know, if you're working on an extremely complex project, the way to tackle that project is to break it down into simpler and smaller components. And then you can focus on each of these components. Right. And do those well. And then, you know, as opposed to trying to tackle this huge, complex monster of a project.
I love what you said before is that people probably assume that because they're multitasking, they're going to get things done faster. You're suggesting that that's actually not true, that it's actually going to take things perhaps longer. And so, I think sometimes, Alexis, you work with individuals, I work with individuals, they almost feel like breaking things down into steps, breaking things down into smaller chunks to simplify a larger complex task, they're kind of averse to it. They're like, oh, that's going to take too long. I don't want to go through those steps to do that. I just want to get it done. And I think, you know, part of what we're seeing is like, I think people assume multitasking is going to make everything quicker, like quick, multitask. And I think what, you know, you're suggesting from your expertise is it's actually going to make everything in the long run slower. So kind of seeing the benefits of doing these things up front is actually going to make your life easier in the long run. It's hard for people to realize that until they actually do it. Lexis and I in our work, you know, sometimes people got to kind of learn the hard way and realize like, okay, what I'm doing is not working. And until you actually do it and employ these strategies and see the benefit, that's when you really get motivated to do it, when you see that it actually helps and works.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Yeah, it's about changing our practices, changing what we're used to. And, you know, people might be used to multitasking, especially when you have a lot of tasks that you have to accomplish. You have a lot of deadlines. You know, I think it's probably natural to think about switching, doing a little bit on this task, switching to something else, switching to something else. And we feel like we're making headway on all of those different deadlines. But the rational thing to do is to instead finish one task and then switch and start on something else.
Yeah, I'll make one more point and Alexis wants to jump in. I think it's a lot of it too is driven by anxiety. We work with individuals who have ADHD and, you know, I'm always trying to determine how much of this is an attentional problem versus how much of this is an emotional problem that's contributing to your attentional problems. And it could be both. But, you know, from my perspective as a therapist working with emotions and understanding people's thought processes and emotions, how that affects attention, you know, I think when people get overwhelmed when there's so much or the things are so complex, I think it's almost like it's an emotional reaction to just switch or to try to find shortcuts or to do all the things that we're saying are not necessarily helpful in the long run. So, you know, my job and Alexis' job is really, we try to help people to kind of tone down their anxiety or help to understand what their fears are. You know, it could be, oh, I'm afraid of, what are you afraid of? Because, you know, a lot of times when people have anxiety, they don't even know what they're afraid of. They're just reacting. Oh, I got to get all my work done. I got to get all A's. I have to do the best at this in the class or this or in my job. And they don't even realize that there's like a fear. There's an underlying fear. They're afraid of something, some consequence in the future. And so to slow them down and to kind of process that fear and that feared consequence helps them to actually manage that anxiety that I think makes their mind all disorganized, which eventually leads to all this disorganized thinking of switching and jumping around and all that stuff. So I think that's an important part that I think gets lost in how we help people with ADHD. Sometimes we think of it, in my opinion at least, that you know, you just got to kind of fix their attention when I think sometimes this really can contribute to the attentional difficulties in the first place.
Well, that's such a great point. Right. When we're experiencing anxiety, it's so hard to focus. And we get into the cycle because we're anxious. We have a difficult time focusing. That makes us even more anxious. And we feel that, oh my gosh, I'm falling behind. What can I do? So we get ourselves into this kind of vicious cycle. And it's such a great point to be able to go back and find what the roots of that anxiety are, right? As a way to help people to focus better, control their attention better.
So I think that's why, you know, a lot of the work that you've done and the research you've done in the field, Gloria, is so important, because getting that biofeedback and being able to slow people down to pay attention to where their attention is going and what maybe is the impetus for it to shift is so fascinating. Because in our day-to-day, I think we just constantly are kind of on autopilot a lot of times to get through all the things that we need to get done. And one of my colleagues and friends over at Boston Children's, Dr. Fogler, loves to say, and I've adopted this on so many different levels, you know, you could do all the things, but at what expense? And I think we don't take the time to pause and to check in with ourselves and say, at what expense am I doing all these things? And I'm grateful in my position and role for the work I do in my private practice, because I get to slow people down and help them have those conversations and the inner metacognitive thinking processes, as you describe in the book too. I love how you have the emphasis and focus on, it's just not about building attention to biohack ourselves or to be more productive, but really, how do we pay attention to how to take care of ourselves as we're functioning in this world?
Yeah, it's really about reframing the whole discussion about attention. And, you know, I think it's our whole culture needs to reframe how we think about productivity and attention, because there really is this emphasis on productivity. I see this among students, among young people, even, you know, colleagues that I've had in academia, also in industry. And I just see how we're driving ourselves crazy from all this pressure to be productive. And there is a trade-off there. And the trade-off is we sacrifice our well-being, right? And so what if we put our well-being first? And, you know, there is plenty of research that shows that when people experience well-being, that they're more creative. Mm. They can do more, right? You can do more when you feel positive. You have more energy, more motivation. Mm. You have better divergent thinking, which is like brainstorming. You can think of better ideas. You can be innovative. And when we're, you know, under the gun and, you know, under pressure, of course, that's when anxiety comes up. And this can mask clear thinking.
Yeah, I love what you both are saying. It is a reframe is so important. And that openness, you kind of, when your mind is open, you're more creative. I think Alexis talks, you know, we always have conversations. Lexi, my sister, always talks about, you know, when I'm not working, I get these ideas. They just come to me when I'm not working. I'm like, yeah, that's great. You know, that's for me, I write songs. And like when I'm just allowing my mind and I'm just noticing what my mind is doing, and I'm like, oh, how's my mind thinking about this? What does this feel like? You know, that's when all these songs come to me. And for a lot of, you know, creative people, that's what happens. I think a lot of people could be more creative if they do that. And also, you know, in psychotherapy, my job in psychotherapy really is to help people to not be this like pressured, focused about what their life is doing, to be productive, to do this, to do that, is to actually allow their mind to open. And that's feeling comfortable. That's feeling more positive, you know, in the relationship, in the context of sitting in the room with me, to help their mind kind of go where it needs to go. And, you know, if you're constantly, as you say in the book, your attention goes where your goals are. And if you're constantly focused on only being productive, then your mind is always going to focus on that because that's what your goal is. And if you don't reframe that goal, you're going to be stuck paying attention to only being productive every time. And, you know, you could end up, you know, losing the very things that are meaningful into your life along the way, including your health, including your relationships and all that. And a lot of therapy is actually helping people get more in touch with what they actually do care about. And as you said, you know, society could be too overly focused on productivity. And that's, you know, an unfortunate thing that could lead to perfectionism, and all those other things that could lead to burnout, as you say, and stress, which, you know, in the short term, it could feel good to be productive like that. In the long term, you know, it could definitely affect you for sure. Real quick. I'm sorry.
Exhaustion and eventual burnout is a very serious problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, it's not uncommon. And so it's really important that we pay attention to signals of exhaustion that can lead to burnout. When people experience burnout, you know, it's just, they are demotivated. They can develop chronic health problems. So it's a very serious condition.
Absolutely. So it's so important. And I know, you know, based on your book, for all those listening, you know, read Dr. Mark's book, you know, there, and she shares, you know, personal anecdotes about how important this is. And it's very, you know, impactful and meaningful to read through that in the beginning of the book. So certainly do. I work with athletes and, you know, I'm going to relate this to athletes. I think it's a very, very clear connection to how coaches coach athletes. Because, you know, if you think about pressure, like, athletics and sports, like that's the pinnacle of pressure, right? You know, we have to win. You know, a lot of coaches take, especially at the higher levels, it's like everybody feels pressure to win. And there's a lot riding on it in the people's minds and careers and all this stuff, right? So, you know, one of the things that you really made a good point of, when there is all this pressure, you know, your attention could be negatively affected by all that pressure. And one of the things I want to, you know, kind of make a almost like a PSA for coaches. when your athlete is not paying attention and or you feel like they're not paying attention, try to maybe reframe what might be going through that person's mind and what might be happening for them. Because I think a lot of coaching is about focus on what you're supposed to do, right? That's kind of like one of the biggest things coaches try to get their athletes to do. Just focus on what you need to do and do it. But what they don't do as coaches as much, what I think could be more integrated into coaching, is try to understand why they weren't, what they actually were focusing on that wasn't what you wanted them to focus on. Instead of just saying, focus, you're not focusing hard enough, you're not trying hard enough. I think Alexis talks about this with students a lot. Like, find out what they were focused on that was actually the wrong thing to focus on, and help them to realize why they were focusing on the wrong thing. Maybe they, you know, were focused on the wrong aspect of a play that they were supposed to enact, or maybe they were distracted by something that they thought was more important, or maybe they were just tired and they're, as you said, burnt out, and they actually need to have a conversation with the coach and say, hey, you gotta, you know, rest better. Let's talk about how you can get more rest or stress in your life. Let's see how you can get a counselor to kind of work through your, you know, your emotional or mental health challenges. So I think, you know, sports is such a great context, and even, you know, in teaching too, as you talked about, Lex, but I think sports is such a great context to reinterpret what it means to pay attention and how to help people with that. Because like I said, coaches are constantly focused, pay attention, do what you're supposed to do. And it misses the point about everything we're just talking about in this conversation.
I love this approach. It's such a comprehensive approach, and it just seems to me that it's a much deeper way to try to get people to really be able to pay attention better, right? As opposed to simply blocking out and ignoring distracting stimuli. Instead, well, let's take a moment and turn and see, what are those distracting stimuli and why are they distracting?
Yes.
So what a great holistic way to think about focus.
I think that's the key. And we really try our best, both on the podcast and in our work, to be able to think about all of the component parts, right? And you talk a lot about this in your book, that it's not just one thing. I have a hard time with social media where things are getting distilled down to like, these are the three things you need to do and you'll be able to be more productive or feel better or live a longer life or whatever it might be. But it really is so much more to that, you know? And you highlight a couple key themes in your book. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what are those main themes that we need to pay better attention to be able to reclaim and maybe have a little more directive control over our attention? Those key things that you come back to, especially at the end of the book, that you kind of point out that it's not just one thing. There is the cognitive resources, there are the personality traits, there's the environment, all these different aspects of what impacts our attention.
Yeah, the traps, like the identity trap, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are so many things that affect our attention in this world. Maybe I can try to summarize it. Let's start with personality. Some people are born lucky with personality traits of being high in conscientiousness and low in impulsivity. These are lucky people, but just because you're not born with a conscientiousness trait doesn't mean that you can't change. And absolutely, you can develop a skill of learning how to be more directed and how to be less impulsive. We're fighting against tech, and tech is designed to distract us. And I write in the book about how, in fact, the whole internet is designed for distraction because of the node and link structure in the internet makes it just so easy for us to surf the internet. And once we start surfing, it's so hard to stop because, you know, the mind is designed in a way that we think by associations. Yeah. So of course, you know, we go off on a spree every time we start surfing the internet. We are social creatures. And, you know, of course, there's many things on the internet that tap into social dynamics, and we respond to social dynamics, such as their, you know, power. We check our emails because we want to find out if our manager is trying to contact us, and we want to demonstrate that we're on the ball.
Mm. Yeah,
We want to be in good standing with our colleagues. We care about social capital. Yeah. So of course we respond to email, texting, phone calls, social media. So there is this social aspect of internet use. We have limited attentional resources. And, you know, I like to use the metaphor of we have this tank. And if you're lucky enough to get a good night's sleep, which we all should be doing, then you can start off your day with a full tank of cognitive resources. Think of it as attentional capacity. Mm. And throughout the day, this attentional capacity drains based on things we do, such as shifting our attention rapidly and getting stressed or experience anxiety that can drain that tank. And we get ourselves into this kind of vicious cycle because when our tank drains, we start to experience cognitive fatigue. And when we have fatigue, we're not as good as filtering out distractions as we are when we're really, you know, have this full tank of resources. And I believe you both study executive function, and yeah. You know how important executive function is to help keep people on track, right? And young people, they're developing executive function. And some kids, when they're very young, when they're put in front of the internet, they have a very hard time controlling where they place their attention because their executive function isn't quite mature enough yet. And so they're very prone to distractions.
Gloria, I wonder what you think about this. I did a parenting talk a couple weeks ago, and a parent asked me, you know, when should we give our children smartphones? And this was in elementary school. And I said, you know, this might sound controversial, but I think you need to wait until they're teenagers at least. I said, you're giving them literally the whole world in their hands that they have access to without much control. I said, you know, whenever I see a child, especially a young child, and believe me, this is not about judgment. It's just about building and developing skills and thinking about neural connections. But when I see a young child in a boring or difficult situation, handed a phone or a screen, I told them, I always think of that as if you're giving them a pacifier, right? Like it's almost as if we're saying, you can't regulate yourself. Here's something to do it for you. Mm,
external.
Which is an external regulator, which I get. Sometimes we're in difficult situations. I don't want to judge parenting.
Of course, yeah.
And we also need to be mindful of how that's reinforcing, you know, when I don't feel good, when I am bored, what do I do? And I think boredom is another missed opportunity to really build and develop skills. And in your book, you talk so much about emotional and self-regulation, and I really appreciate that. I wonder what your thoughts are.
I'm with you. I do not believe that children should have smartphones. You know, my kids were raised without television.
Yeah, I love that.
They were raised in a time before smartphones.
Yeah.
And so they rebelled. You know, their friends all had TV. And I was always surprised how my kids were up on the latest TV shows. It was only because they heard about it from their friends.
Yeah.
And so they rebelled and we resisted. And I'll tell you a story. I wrote about this in the book that my husband and I were on sabbatical in Berlin, and we rented a flat that had two TV sets. And one time I was trying to work and my kids were hovering around me and, you know, I wasn't able to work. And I said to them, go watch TV. And you know what they said? They said, no, it's boring. And then I realized that I had really done something right. That all those years of restricting them from TV and giving them books instead to read was it paid off. And so what I would say to parents, and I get it, I understand, parenting is hard.
Very.
It's really one
so
of the
difficult.
Hardest and most challenging things we can do.
Yes.
You know, I would say, think about replacing activities. And it is very easy to give a kid a smartphone or a tablet to entertain them. But think instead of what else you can give to the child. You can give the child books.
Yeah.
Give the child a book, or send the child outside, right? I mean, think about how you can replace that child's interest with something else. Because when we give smartphones and tablets to kids at a very young age, it develops a habit.
Yeah.
And it becomes an extremely small, strong habit. And there's expectations that the moment that a child is bored, that child wants to have something, some quick fix, mm-hmm. like watching a YouTube video. But there are other things that can provide more rewarding and fulfilling things for that child than smartphones.
And sometimes they need an actual snack, hopefully one that's nutritious. It might actually help them with how they're feeling in that moment too, rather than just a digital snack.
Yeah, you know, I was actually surprised when my kids were very young and we lived in Germany. And I was very surprised that there was a headmaster of a school who said, you know, when your child acts up, it's because they're hungry, because
yeah.
their blood sugar is low.
That was a good headmaster.
Never, ever had occurred to me. And yeah, it can work wonders.
Yeah, it's so true. Going back to those biomarkers of understanding like what we actually need in different situations. You know, we talked on a couple episodes that even when I feel like a disconnection to people, sometimes I go to social media because it helps me to feel more connected to people that I don't see all the time, right? And there's this like understandable urge and desire to do these things. And I love how you talk about being able to just, you know, have those opportunities to mind wander, to kind of downgrade your attentional level, to not have to be as focused in a moment. And that actually helps to replenish us too. And we talked a lot about sleep. We had a great episode. Dr. Jade Wu from the Duke Sleep Clinic came on, who's a friend and colleague of ours, and talked about mind wandering and naps and breaks. And I wonder from your research, if you could share a little bit about that too, how breaks and maybe downgrading the things we pay attention to more rote tasks actually helps to replenish our attention.
Yeah, it's so important. I mean, it's another myth to think that we should try to achieve nonstop focus over the day. And, yeah. you know, if you search the internet, you'll see all kinds of consultants and programs that are designed for you to, you know, focus 10 hours straight, focus nonstop.
Oh my God.
No, thank you.
You'll find these. And, you know, we can't focus nonstop in the same way that we can't physically take on some hard task like lifting weights nonstop mm-hmm. without getting exhausted. And so we need breaks, right? And what our research showed was that people have personal rhythms. We have peaks and valleys in our attentional focus. There are some times in the day when we're at our peak, and it's individual. You know, it depends on things like chronotype, if you're an early type or late type, depends on how much sleep you got, depends on the tasks you're doing, you know, the meetings you've went to. It depends on a number of things, but we do have these rhythms. And so get to know when your peak focus time is. Don't waste it. Don't use that time to do email or social media, but use it to do really hard creative work. And then get to know when your valleys are. And that's when we should be taking a break, right? Or that's when you can relax and you can do rote kinds of activities. And these rote activities could be, yeah, it could be a simple game, But I want to emphasize, I am not advocating that we play simple games for a long period of time, but for a few minutes. Mm. Like you have a meeting that's coming up in 5 minutes. You can use it to calm your mind, settle down, relax in those 5 minutes before you start that meeting. Some people do knitting. One person who I spoke to has this screen in his office that he bounces a ball against.
Nice.
And that's his kind of rote activity. And it's his way of just calming his mind down. So there's nothing inherently bad in doing some simple activity that can calm us down. And social media is fine as long as we don't go down a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
It's human and natural for us to be distracted, right? We're human beings. The problem is not that we're distracted or that we do these rote activities. The problem is that when we can't stop.
Do you feel like because we become so sedentary as a society where we're sitting more than we ever have, that context has made it so that we're always looking for stimulation because we're not actually moving around where it would be more stimulating to like go for a walk more or like go out and play, like because we're always sitting down for our jobs, for school, for this, for that, that it's almost like our brains are craving some sort of stimulation because we're always sedentary?
That's such a great question. And I think it's hard to disentangle being sedentary and being on a screen. So I just saw the Nielsen Total Audience Report. This was for 2020. It was done before the pandemic. And it shows that people are on some kind of media about half the day, like 12 hours and 20 minutes on average. Oh, and this media is, it's everything from, could be radio, could be computers, TV, smartphones. So people are really attached to media. And so it's hard to separate. Yes, we are sedentary. And in fact, in a study that we did, it was actually right before the pandemic, we found, and this is using sensors so we could get really precise measures and information, that information workers, which is what you are, what I am, many people are, they spend 90% of their day sedentary. Mm-hmm. And it used to not be that way, right? People spent much less of their time just sitting down. But when people are sitting down, what are they doing? They're in front of a screen most of the time. Those 12 hours a day, a good part of that is that people are sedentary. And so, yes, if people were moving around, they would have a chance to be observing stimuli in the environment. Of course, you shouldn't be on a smartphone. Right. If you're moving around, right?
Especially in Boston, there's so many college students walking around just looking down all the time. And I quietly and politely say, look up, as I walk by them sometimes.
I think Dr. Nicole Moyen on the physical exercise episode we did last season said, like, you know, when you leave the room, when you go outside, your view is panoramic. Mm. Like you can see a wide scope of your environment. When you're looking at a screen, your focus is narrow. And I guess, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that being able, I mean, I think screens nowadays are like humongous, like Rob's screen over there, our producer, the screen is like, what, like 40 inches. But still, like, I think it's something about like kind of narrowing your focus on one area versus when you're outside in nature, like you kind of get a panoramic full, you know, 360 view of what's around you.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I also think when our attention is on our screens, we lose that sense of proprioception, of bodily perception.
Yes.
And so when you're moving around, when you're exercising, you know, you do have a sense of your body moving through space.
Mm.
And especially for young children, it's so important because it helps them learn, you know, basic motor skills and, you know, coordination. But when we're sitting in front of a screen, we don't have that sense, and we're not learning skills of coordination. So
interesting. That's such a good point.
That's so interesting, especially with the kids with ADHD that I work with, that oftentimes they do lack, you know, a suitable, adequate amount of proprioception to be able to keep their bodies in balance throughout their day. That's why they're often in constant motion, I find.
That's a good point.
That's such a really good point. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Mm. You don't practice kind of using your body, then you're going to have a hard time, you know, regulating your body.
And these are the kids that are most likely drawn to a screen as a point of a break for them, right? Rather than, you know, they enjoy getting outside and running around, but oftentimes they gravitate more to a screen than just the physical activity.
Mm. Great point. Gloria, there's one last point that I want to make, and then maybe you and Alexis can kind of wrap up the episode with some key things you want to get in here. But I really... When video games came out, you know, when I was a kid growing up, video games became really big. And I always felt like video games was kind of like this experience. As I got older, I'm like, you know, video games are kind of like a false sense of control. And I feel like when you're using video games, you kind of learn how to control things. Like, it takes time to learn how the game works, the strategy of the game, the environment of the game, and you can kind of learn it and keep doing it over and over and repeat, you know, you lose, you come back, you reset, you keep going, that you kind of figure out how to control the game. I think the internet, social media is much like that now too. You feel like you have so much control over what you're doing and how you're manipulating things in the virtual reality. And I've always had this thought about how that affects people's ability to navigate the real world outside of this virtual world. And I'm wondering if, you know, it makes people more anxious to deal with real life in moment challenges, issues, things that come up where you feel out of control because you're so used to manipulating everything digitally that you feel like, oh, well, I have no control here because there's no button to push to deal with this situation.
Well, that's a very interesting idea. It's true. You are the operator when you're, you know, in front of that console and doing that video game. But in the real world, you're not necessarily the operator. You might be an operator of yourself, but you can't control other people. You can't necessarily control the environment. So it's an interesting thought. I think that, the value of spending time in the environment is, and especially with other people, is that people learn signals. And when you're with other people, you learn social signals. You learn how to interpret them. You learn how you can, interact and talk with other people. And you learn everything from turn-taking to, you know, what's appropriate to talk about. But when you're playing a video game, you know, it's not always a two-way interaction. It can be. I know that some video games involve pretty intense coordination. Mm-hmm. But if you're not playing a game collaboratively with other people, it's just you and the game. And you're not learning the same kinds of signals as you might learn in real life, especially when interacting with other people.
It's so interesting. I had a student yesterday who wanted to take a break by watching a video game. And I had to press pause. I said, let's just assess the situation. What are we noticing here? And he's like, well, I like playing this game. I said, yeah, I totally get that. I said, but this guy is in a room by himself right now, playing a video game, talking to no one, and you're watching him do this. I'm like, what is the value here? What are we actually benefiting from it? And he was just enthralled, but it was a very interesting exploration and a point of curiosity to kind of engage in that, you know, oftentimes we become so isolating when we feel like we have the most control. We become so isolated when we feel like we have the most control, which I think limits our experiences and exposure.
Definitely. And complex issues in life are like uncomfortable and challenging. And there's a lot of nuance to them. There's a lot of dynamics involved, as you said, Gloria, you know, in terms of interpersonally working with people. And I think when you think you can solve some big societal problem by making a post, and maybe there certainly could be benefit, it gets information out. I think there's huge benefits, right, to information being getting out. But like, if you're going to enter into a situation in the real world that's going to try to, you know, address a complex issue, that's going to, like, it could be way more complex than one social media post makes it to be. That to actually solve the problem, to actually make progress, to actually deal with all the variables that are involved and all these different perspectives of different people who are involved in this complex issue, to take all of those things into account and to find a reasonable solution that's going to work and make sense, that is extremely hard to do, and it's very uncomfortable, and you have to work with people collaboratively to do that. And I think sometimes there's an idea by looking at a post that, oh, it's simple and we can solve this problem by posting or looking at a post, and to actually make progress on a very challenging, complex issue is very hard, and people have to work together and deal with all these variables. There's so many variables involved that aren't always taken into account because it's hard to look at all the variables. It's hard for, you know, a very high intellectual person to take all these variables into account and to make a decision that's going to be a reasonable solution to a complex problem. I think that's one of the challenges of social media as well.
Yeah, I was thinking it's the difference between a closed system and an open system. And so this young person who chooses to watch another video player playing the game, that becomes a closed system because they're not getting... And an open system is when you get information from a lot of different sources. And this young person is simply watching another closed system, right? This other person playing the game. And they're not learning the information they would learn if they were in the external world and moving around and talking with a lot of different people and doing a lot of different activities other than video gaming. They're exposing themselves to new information that and then they have to learn how to interact with this new information.
Right. Like take bullying as an example. Everybody, you know, most people, if they were to think deeply in their heart, they don't want bullying to happen. Like, you know, people can, you know, be mean and stuff, but if you were to look on deep down in people, I don't think people are truly that mean that they really think bullying is a good thing. I think most people don't want bullying to happen, but it's a complex issue that can happen in a school. And it's great that we can make a post and say, stop bullying, make bullying stop. It's not good. But to really enact in a school system to help bullying to stop is a very complex problem. And so I'm just using this as an example that I think sometimes social media can simplify how to fix a complex problem, when the reality is it would help, you know, bullying, number one, is a relational dynamic thing. It's very complicated, and you got to figure out how to not only address the bully, but also the person being targeted, the people around them, the culture of the school, all these things. It's a very complex thing that takes, you know, work, effort, uncomfortable feelings, perspective taking, you know, complex critical thinking, collaboration, all these things. And I guess, you know, I'm going on a tangent here, but I feel like, you know, like really helping something get better is hard work and it's complex. And sometimes social media can pull our attention to simplifying things that are not so simple.
Yep.
I think that's why I love your book so much, because it's not just picking apart one study and one piece of information. It's really looking at the broader landscape of where our world, society, a lot of different influences are coming into play to help us just to pay attention that we need to preserve and almost respect our own attention as a resource, that we have something that is a part of us as a human, to be able to understand what we do with it and how we use our attention to be able to contribute to the broader world and finding our own purpose and how we direct our attention. So I'm so grateful for all the work that you do and all of the information that you provided. I mean, this book, for those of you who haven't read it yet, it dives so deeply into the history, the systems, thinking about the cognitive processes, thinking about the interrelationships of so much. And it really just brings about these ideas that we need to pay better attention to ourselves, right? And figure out what we really need. And Gloria, before we wrap up, I have to say, one of the things I love most about the people who have played such an influential role in my life, mentors, professors, teachers, and guides, They're people who look at the bigger picture. And this is why I think I was so connected to your book too, is because you look at the bigger picture of so much. And I know that your original training was more in the arts, and it shifted into, you know, the cognitive processes and psychology. And I wonder if you could just share a little bit about your journey, because I think it pulls all the pieces of everything we've been talking about together, and hopefully will serve as an inspiration for others too.
So I did start out as an artist. I have my undergraduate degree is a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree, and never thought I would do anything else. But it is hard to make a living as an artist. And I also had skills in math. So I thought, well, maybe I'll leverage those and I'll do something where it would be easier to get a job. But, you know, since then, and going back and looking at my art training, I realize how valuable it's been for me. And it's because in art, you learn what's called lateral thinking, where you connect two very different ideas together and come up with a discovery, something new. And that's not taught in science.
Yeah.
Some people are good at it and some aren't so good at it. But it's this kind of lateral thinking is a skill that can be brought into any profession. And it's something, I mean, it could be used in teaching, it could be used in business and in science. And so I'm such an advocate for people learning something in the arts. And I really think that school curricula, I know that a lot of arts curricula is cut out of K through 12 education, but it's so important to keep that in and for young people to find something that they're really passionate about, and it could be painting, drawing, sculpture, dance, music. I mean, there's so many areas in the arts that writing that can make a difference. And so it certainly has helped me and has taught me just the importance of being creative in whatever I do.
I love that, Gloria. And let me ask you this question. Aside from the cognitive benefits of it, what are the emotional benefits of being involved in art?
It's a tremendous fulfillment. You feel very, very rewarded and fulfilled. The other experience is that when you do something in art, it's so easy to become immersed and get into a state of flow. And a lot of people mistakenly believe that, oh, I should be in flow all the time. Someone who's doing information work and, you know, thinks, why can't I get into flow? You know, information work is not conducive for getting people into flow. But doing something creative, yes. When I did art, I regularly got into flow. And it is an emotional experience because you feel so, I would say, fulfilled, and you're passionate in what you're doing, and time just passes by. You're just not aware of time. It's a joyful experience, very joyful. And so, that's another argument for people doing something in the arts or even a hobby. You know, you can get into flow if you're very passionate about a hobby that you have. So it's a very positive experience.
That's so great. You know, I think our mom gave me Csikszentmihalyi's book Flow like 25 years ago, and it's been something that's guided me personally and professionally in my entire life. So I love that you brought that up, and I think that's a really great place for us to wrap things up. In thinking about attention isn't just about this focused productivity. It really is about appreciating, understanding, and just embracing the flow of life, whatever you might be focused on.
Totally.
Yeah, Gloria, we're so grateful. Any last thoughts before we wrap up?
Well, I I appreciate that you bring in your own perspectives, your own psychological perspectives into talking about attention. And I think that you've really illustrated how broad and comprehensive a topic attention is, right? It's more than just here are the tips you need to focus, but you're really taking a deep dive and, you know, taking a very broad and holistic perspective and seeing how it connects to emotions and how it connects with other people and how it connects with the activities we're doing and how it connects with our executive function. I mean, there's so many different aspects involved in attention, and attention is part of life, right?
We're so grateful for you, Gloria. This has been great. What a great episode. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for, yeah, thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for tuning in to the Read Connected podcast. Please remember that this is a podcast intended to educate and share ideas, but it is not a substitute for professional care that may be beneficial to you at different points of your life. If you are in need of support, please contact your primary care physician, local hospital, educational institution, or support staff at your place of employment to seek out referrals for what may be most helpful for you. Ideas shared here have been shaped by many years of training, incredible mentors, research, theory, evidence-based practices, and our work with individuals over the years, but it's not intended to represent opinions of those we work with or who we are affiliated with. The Reconnected podcast is hosted by siblings Alexis Reed and Dr. Gerald Reed. Original music is written and recorded by Gerald Reed. Editing and recording was done by Cybersound Studios. If you want to follow along on this journey with us, the Reconnected podcast will be releasing new episodes every 2 weeks each season. So please subscribe for updates and notifications. Feel free to also follow us on Instagram at ReadConnectedPodcast. That's ReadConnectEdPodcast, and Twitter at ReadConnectEd. We are grateful for you joining us and look forward to future episodes. In the meanwhile, be curious, be open, and be well.